Hi, I'm Brittany. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'm nervous, as always. And I've never shared for 45 minutes, so I'm going to just give it a shot. I'll start with my sobriety birthday. I got sober August 1st, 2014. So just last month, I celebrated 8 years, which is a miracle. Thank you. Thank you. Gosh, so much has happened in the last 8 years. I feel like I was just talking about this with Joe and Liz. I feel like I grew up in AA because I did grow up in AA. I grew up with two parents who are alcoholic and drug addicts. And so I grew up in chaos, but I also got to watch the miracles that can happen in the rooms of AA and NA. I work the AA program, but drugs were my choice. Drugs is what took me down. But I look at it like I can't drink alcohol because at the bottom of that bottle is my drug of choice every single time. So I feel like as a child, as a child, I exhibited certain behaviors that were not normal. So I always felt like I wasn't different. I always felt like I was different. And I always felt like I was seeking something to take me out of myself, to feel different. I never felt comfortable in a room of people, including my family. And I watched my parents, both of them, they were both partiers, and they divorced when I was 5 years old. So I was with my mom half the week and my dad half the week. And but both sides, they like to party. And so that was when I saw them at their happiest. So I related happiness to drinking and partying, because when they weren't drinking and when they weren't partying, they were miserable and or fighting or isolating in their bedrooms with the door shut, and I was taking care of myself. And so, but when they started drinking or when inviting people into their homes, that's when the laughter, when I got to witness laughter and happiness. And so I remember growing up thinking, when I'm old enough to drink, I'm going to drink. When I'm old enough to smoke weed, I'm going to try it. I was always curious about that. And my parents tell me this story. I was 2 years old, and I used to call beer daddy's juice, because my dad always had a beer in his hand. And my mom couldn't find me, and I was 3 years old. She couldn't find me. And then she's looking all over the house screaming my name, and I'm behind the couch with a bottle of wine and Monopoly. And I'm drinking the wine and I'm playing Monopoly by myself, because that's what I watched them do, play games and drink. And then there was another time when I was around that age, and I drank a beer, probably half the thing is what they said. And so I was always trying to get into things like that and to, you know, feel what my parents were feeling, because I really honestly believe that that's what made them happy. I mean, it was, because they were alcoholics. And so I was always really curious about that. And I remember in middle school, we would start experimenting, and I would steal cigarettes from my mom and meet up with my friends, and we would drink and smoke weed, and we'd all get in trouble. And the difference between me and my friends was, my friends, they would stop because they were in trouble. They were scared to continue. But me, it was, no, we just got to figure out how to be sneakier. The consequences didn't matter to me. They never did. So I grew up in that, and my mom finally got sober, not for good, but she came into these rooms when I was 7 years old, and I would go to meetings with her. And so I watched the miracle with her, because she was sober for 4 years, and those were probably the best memories I had with my mom as a child. But as a teenager, because this is a disease, and once I put that in my body for the first time, it was on. It started progressing at a very early age for me. It was nonstop. I was on right when I tried it. I felt good. I finally felt like I found myself. And it didn't matter what happened, it didn't matter what kind of consequences I experienced. I couldn't stop. Even when I got to a point when I wanted to stop, I couldn't stop. But I look back at all of that, and I'm so grateful I experienced that at a young age, and that even though the disease of addiction runs in my family, recovery also runs in families as well. And I remember that I'm a mother now, and my son is 13 years old, and it scares the hell out of me because it runs deep in our family. Both of my grandparents died from alcoholism, and on all sides. So recovery runs in families. I truly believe that. I witness it every day in my family and in other families. But yes, going back to my childhood, I kind of got to slow down. I'm going to be jumping everywhere, and this is just how I speak. So I got pregnant at 17 years old, and I was good when I was pregnant, but after I had my son, it was back on. And I really didn't believe I had a problem at the time. I thought I was just a young person just wanting to have fun. And how dare my parents accuse me of having a problem? Because I correlated I compared myself to them because alcohol was their thing. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I could drink and put it down, but it was the drugs. And I thought, oh, I'm 17, I'm 18 years old. Everyone does drugs, but no, it's not normal. 17, 18 year olds don't do meth. They don't steal benzos from their parents. They don't do that. It's not normal. But we grow up thinking it's normal because we're surrounded by that. And we hang out with people who are like that. And so it was normal for me. It did seem like a thing that kids my age did because that's who I was hanging out with. So after having my son, it was really hard because I was 18 years old and I was an addict even though I didn't know I was. And so I tried. I tried to be the best parent I could be, but this disease, it consumes your whole life. And it doesn't matter how much you love somebody or something, when you have this disease, you don't have control. You're powerless, completely powerless over everything. So when I got to that point when I really wanted to stop, it didn't matter what you took away from me. I had to get to a point where I wanted it. And they say you have to want it for yourself to get sober. Yes, that's partly true, but at first I needed to walk into these rooms for somebody else at first, because then that grows. Hopefully that seed is planted and then it grows. And then eventually I learn, yes, I do want this for myself. But yeah, it doesn't matter how much you love something. It really doesn't. You could put me on a lie detector test and ask me, do you want to be sober? And I'm going to say yes. And I'm going to honestly mean it. But the next day, the pain and the suffering and the misery that I was feeling the day before, once that craving takes over my mind and that obsession, you forget. You forget that pain and that misery, and you forget how badly you wanted to be sober. That doesn't matter anymore. That goes out the window. So the second I put something in my body, that craving takes over. That craving becomes that obsession, and it consumes my everyday thoughts. So when I first came into these rooms, it was because I was forced to do it. I had an ultimatum: get sober or lose your family. And between a year and 8 months, I went to 4 different programs. I walked into my first rehab January 1st, 2013. And so it took me a year and 8 months to finally get sober. And in that year and 8 months, like I said, I went to 4 programs. So the first program I went to, it was, like I said, lose your son or go get help. I was living at my parents'. Let me back up a little bit. So I was living at my parents' with my son and struggling, of course, and they started noticing there was something wrong with me. And at this point, my dad was sober. My dad got sober when I was 16 years old. And so he knew exactly what I needed. He knew what was going on with me, even though I didn't believe it. I just thought they were controlling and they assume I'm like them because of how they are and all that, those feelings of resentment and how dare you. And I hated them for this. I hated them. And so, but I couldn't live without my son. So I caved in and I walked into my first treatment program and I was there for 30 days. And in that 30 days, I learned a lot, even though I wasn't ready, but I learned a lot. But the problem was I wasn't ready to surrender. And that's another big piece to this, is fully surrendering and accepting that you're powerless. And surrendering means many different things. It means going to meetings when you don't want to, reaching your hand out, talking to people, working with people in the program. It means working the steps, going into an SLE even though you don't want to, just doing things that you don't want to do is, for me, is how I needed to surrender. I needed to surrender to my higher power, especially, number one. But I wasn't ready to surrender. I wasn't ready to let go of my power, the power that I thought I had. And so I walked out of that program and I went to an SLE immediately and I tried it. I started going to NA meetings and heroin was my drug of choice. I don't know if I mentioned that. Started with opiates. My mom in high school, she would give me benzos to calm me down. And she would give me Vicodin if I wanted it. My mom had an addiction to pills, and but back then we didn't know how dangerous benzos were. I mean, it doesn't make it right regardless, but benzos weren't such a thing back then when I was in high school. And so I remember when she gave me my first Vicodin at 16, oh my God, I loved it. I could kind of function. It wasn't like being drunk and sloppy. And it made me feel like I was just in heaven, floating on a cloud. And from that moment, at 16 years old, taking my first Vicodin, it didn't take over my life right away. It was slow and progressive at first with the pills. And so I would just, you know, whenever I could get my hands on it is when I would use it. It didn't become a daily thing yet. And so at 16, 17, I was just doing whatever I could get my hands on. But I remember there was these, I don't know if anyone's heard of Fizz pills. It's a pressed pill. It's a mix of ecstasy and they put meth in it too. But back then I didn't know they were putting that in it. And so that was a really popular thing when I was in high school. And so I remember doing it for the first time, ninth grade, I was 15. And I fell in love with that as well. And so I would do it in class, and then it became an every weekend thing. Every single weekend I was doing that. And I lived at my mom's on the weekends. And so my dad was sober when I was 16, but I was only with him Monday through Thursday. So on the weekends I was with my mom, and so I got to really just do whatever I wanted on the weekends. And I met my son's father when I was 15. He was my first boyfriend, and his dad was a drug dealer. And so he had all this access to weed. And so I was 15 years old, going over to my boyfriend's house on the weekends. I started smoking a lot more weed. And my dad couldn't really control me because I was at my mom's. And so that was really hard for them. And it was a battle. It was confusing. My dad had the nice big house and my mom lived in like a shack. And so I would live with my dad, and I felt like middle class with my dad and then lower class with my mom, and they both had different rules. So not only did I grow up an addict and alcoholic, but I grew up with a lot of confusion. And I remember like going back to my dad's house on Monday, they would have to like reprogram me. And then I'd go to my mom's and I was just a wild, free child. And so it was really hard. It was hard growing up like that. I felt like I lived out of a suitcase. I was always having to pack, unpack, pack, unpack 4 times a week. And so anyways, back to the father of my son. Once I started dating him at 15, then my life started going downhill progressively. And I remember my dad would try to control me from seeing him. And he was 18, my boyfriend, and I was 15. And that was my addiction. That was one of my drugs of choices. So I have many things I'm addicted to. And one of them was men. One of them was love. I just wanted love. And I felt like my boyfriend at the time gave that love to me that I didn't feel like I was getting from at home. And so when my dad tried taking him away from me and not letting me see him, it was like losing my drug of choice. The feelings I would feel was like the feelings of withdrawal. And so I remember my he got sick. He has Crohn's disease, my boyfriend at the time. And so he was at the Oakland Children's Hospital for a week. And I remember, this is how crazy I was, at 15 years old, they would take me to school and I would immediately leave, hop on a bus. The bus would take me to the BART station, hop on the BART, go to Oakland, get on a shuttle, go to the children's hospital at 15 years old. My parents had no idea, but that's the kind of stuff I'll do to get what I want. I will put myself in harm's way to get what I want. I needed that. I needed him, and that's how I felt at the time. And so when I turned 16 years old, he ended up going to jail for being with me because he was 18, but he was 19 when I was 16. And so my dad found a way to put him in jail for being with me. And he was in jail for about 6 weeks. And when he got out, my dad made sure to hold on to my cell phone to see if he would call me, and he called me. And so he broke probation and he was sent right back to jail. So he was there for a year. And God, I remember, he was the only thing I thought about for a whole year. I can't wait till he gets out. When he gets out, the first thing I'm gonna do is see him. I didn't care. Consequences didn't matter to me with anything. So when he got out of jail after being there for a year, that's when I got pregnant with him. And I had another boyfriend when he got out of jail, and I cheated on my boyfriend with him, got pregnant, and it's just, my life was so chaotic back then. But I ended up having my son, and thank God, because if it wasn't for him, I feel like I'd be dead. I don't think I would have gone to rehab at that age if it wasn't for him. I wouldn't have at that age. So that's what, I work today as a drug and alcohol counselor. So when people walk into my program and they're not ready, that's okay, because I wasn't ready. But that seed that you're planting is so important, because that seed will one day grow into something. So no matter how not ready somebody is, it's always worth it to go up to them and talk to them, even if they don't think that they have a problem. And so I got pregnant with my son, and it didn't end up working out with his father. And so we did not get back into a relationship after he got out of jail. He kind of went his own way and I went my own way, and had my son. But like I said earlier, right after having my son, it was back on. It was back on. I tried going to college and I couldn't. Back then I would say, oh, it's because I have a kid. But no, it was just because I wasn't ready to do anything that didn't involve partying and drugs. And so at that time, I didn't have the pill problem yet. I was just using it, you know, occasionally, but I was smoking weed every day and drinking on occasion. And I tried, I had to move back to my dad's house. I had my own apartment when I was 18 with my son, and that didn't work out because I couldn't take care of any responsibility. I couldn't keep up on any bills, on anything. I was so irresponsible. So I moved back into my dad's house, and my son was 1 year old at the time, and the plan was I was gonna get my life back together. And I was gonna go back to school. I was gonna become a pharmacy technician. I had this plan. And so I remember I took an Adderall like the first week living at my dad's house. And Adderall is like, it's an amphetamine. So it's like, you know, taking meth or using meth. And my stepmom, who's also in the program and who's been my stepmom since I was five, she met my dad when I was 5 years old, and they got married and have been together ever since. So when he got sober at when I was 16, she got sober too. They got sober together. So she knew right away that I was on something. And she always knew. Thank God for her, seriously. Because my dad would be in denial about it sometimes, but she knew. So she questioned, every time she suspected something, I was interrogated for hours because there was no way I was going to be honest. I would lie, and we'd end up sitting there for hours, it felt like, with her and him, like, standing over me, questioning me, and every time, it always came down to, okay, we're going to drug test you. And then I would continue to lie. I would say, okay, fine, drug test me. And then once I, after peeing in that cup, then I would come clean. But I always had that hope that they wouldn't actually drug test me. So it showed amphetamine, because when you take an Adderall, that's what you test positive for. And they were like, you can't live here if you do anything like that. And so I was going to give an honest attempt at bettering my life after that. And so I stopped smoking weed. And I started going to school. And I went to Carrington College to become a pharmacy technician. And I did so good. I was on the, what's it called, the dean's list or the president's list or something like that. I had all A's. So I was doing the pharmacy tech classes and then online to get my general education classes out of the way too. And wasn't smoking weed. I was doing amazing. But then I started smoking weed after probably 8 months of doing great in school. It was a 2-year program. And so I started smoking weed. And you would think that, oh, it's just weed. Weed's not going to ruin somebody's life. But me, the kind of addict I am, anything can ruin my life. Food can ruin my life. Shopping can ruin my life. And so I started smoking weed. And I went from being straight A student to you'd have to wear scrubs to class. And so I would put on my scrubs and take my son to daycare. And instead of going to school, I would go to my friend's house and just smoke weed all day. And I did that like once. And then maybe 2 weeks later, I did it again. It was kind of fun because, you know, I'm 19 years old and I'm a mom and I'm a single mom. And so it's really hard to find times to just hang out with your friends. And I had the county paying for my daycare. So it was like the perfect way to have like a day to myself. My son's being watched by the daycare lady. My parents think I'm in school. And so I'm at my friend's house smoking weed all day and nobody knows, nobody's gonna question me. I'm gonna come home in my scrubs. And so I did that one time, but then 2 weeks later, I did it again. Then the next week I did it again. And then it slowly became an everyday thing. And that's just how it works for me. It progresses. And so I ended up dropping out and leaving my house every day in scrubs to go to my friend's house. Every day for months until my parents got something in the letter in the mail and they opened it. And it was a letter saying like, I don't remember what it said, but it was like, talking about me getting dropped or whatever, and they're like, what's going on? Why are you getting, you're not going to school? And so they found out that I wasn't going to school and I had been lying for months. I got away with doing this for months and I wasn't doing hard drugs yet. I was just smoking weed at this point. So just smoking weed, look what that does to me. Look how it changes my behavior. I'm lying to everyone around me and sitting on my friend's couch all day doing nothing, while my son is being taken care of by some stranger. But that doesn't matter to me. And so every time I get caught, then it's always like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, blah, 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 blah. And then so I re-signed up for school and I was able to do that without having to get another, to pay another fee or whatever. So they were nice, they let me go back in. And so I tried to do it, but I couldn't do it. And I thought, you know what, I'll just get a regular job. I'm not ready for school right now. And so I tried looking for a job and nobody would hire me. And I couldn't figure out why is nobody hiring me. And so my friend at the time, she talks me into going to San Francisco and working at this club, a nightclub. And I kept telling her, no, I can't. And so finally I had nothing left. I claimed Jumper wouldn't hire me. It's like, okay, this other restaurant, like I didn't get a job at the fifth restaurant I interviewed at. And these restaurants aren't even hiring me. And I need something. I need some sort of income. So I said, fine, I'll try it. And I went there and tried out and I got the job. And I was 20 years old. And that is where my addiction took off. Because I'm in the city and my parents thought I was working at a casino, the Pacheco Casino. And really I was going to the city every day. And so I still had that daycare and I found a woman that worked at night that would watch my son at night. And so it was on, it was a party every single day at work because you're allowed to do drugs, drink, just do whatever you want and make a lot of money. And so, my friend started getting into Roxy's. There are these, it's a version of Oxycontin and you can snort it. And so I remember back in high school, I would do that sometimes and that feeling I would get from it. And so I tried it with her and you know, that's my drug of choice, opiates. I fell right in love with it again. And then I started doing it every day, not realizing that my body's gonna become physically addicted to it. And so there was one day I couldn't get it, and oh my God, it was terrible, those withdrawals. And so I knew I had a problem, but I still couldn't see that I was an addict. I just couldn't call myself an addict. It's amazing how our mind can live in denial and what it does to justify and rationalize our behavior, to blame everyone around us except for ourselves. I blamed my parents. I blamed my dad and my stepmom. It was always poor me, I'm the victim, I'm the stepchild that doesn't get love, and my dad always works, and I mean, that's all bullshit. I know they love me to death, but that's what the things I would tell myself, poor me, because it made me feel better about living in that victim mentality, because I'm not the problem, everyone else around me is the problem, and if they would just leave me alone or give me the love I need, then I'd be happy and I wouldn't need to use drugs. And so, my life really quickly, I worked there for a year. And in that year, I became a full-blown opiate addict. And I was not just using opiates. I was using anything I can get my hands on. And so my parents then really started noticing that there was something wrong with me. And I remember one night I would use, I don't know if anyone knows what Xanax is, but it's a benzo, and when you take it, you black out. And so I remember I took it that day, but I don't remember what happened the rest of the night. So the next morning, my dad comes in my room and he's yelling at me, and I don't know why he's yelling at me. And he was like, give me your phone, I'm done with you. And we got into a really big fight. And I was like, what, why, I worked yesterday and I came home and then I went to the movies and why are you yelling at me? He's like, no, you didn't. I came into your bedroom at 2 a.m. and you're crawling through the window. I must have left or something, and my son was in the bed though, and I don't know what I did, but I guess he caught me crawling back into my window. I live on they have a two-story house and my bedroom's upstairs. So I got onto the roof and I was sneaking back in, I guess, and he caught me in the middle of it. And so that's when he gave me that first ultimatum, because I wouldn't give him my phone. He was paying my phone bill, so he had a right to take my phone, but I wouldn't give it to him. And so then that's when he said, okay, then you need to get the hell out of my house and don't come back until you get help. And so I was like, fine, fuck you. And I left the house, and I was gone for a week, and they kept my son. So in that week, I was so miserable. I can't live without my son. That's the one thing I can't live without. I was thinking, I know I need help because I can't get off this, but I didn't want to change my life. I wanted to continue because it was a party every day at work, and even though I was miserable, it's just like this weird, I don't know, it's weird. I knew I needed help, but I didn't think I needed the kind of help they wanted me to get. So after a week of being out on my own without my son, I was too miserable to live like that. And so I remember meeting them at Roundtable to talk, because then they found out where I was actually working, because when I was gone for that week, they were cleaning out my disgusting bedroom, getting all the crap out of it, and they found the contract to my job. And so I sit down with them at round table, and they have the paper in front of them, and they're like, okay, we know where you're actually working. My dad's crying. And they say, you cannot have your son, you cannot take care of your son until you get help. And I looked at them and I said, I know, I'm ready to get help. I'm willing to do what I need to do. And they had me sign this paper, and they told me it was so that way they could take my son to doctor's appointments while I was gone. But that paper was something different. I didn't read it. It was so that way they can go to court and fight for guardianship, and I wouldn't be notified. Because, you know, whenever you go to court with someone, you have to notify them what's going on. But I signed away my right to be notified. So I had no idea what they were doing. And so while I was in that first program, they were doing that, and they got guardianship of him, thank God. But at the time, I hated them for it. And so, like I said, it was January 1st, 2013. I walked into my first rehab, learned a lot. The deal was I had to live in an SLE after graduating. So I moved into an SLE, and I went to my first NA meeting for myself, because I used to go with my mom for her. And I remember sitting there, and I just, like, the people in the room, I didn't relate with them. Like, they were weird to me, and I didn't want to talk to them. And my sponsor was weird. She told me to call her every day for 30 days before we worked on the steps. And so I would forget, and then I'd have to start over. And so that was weird to me. And I had a boyfriend who I was with for, we were friends in high school. And so I started dating him when I was 21, a year before I went to rehab. So we had been with each other for a year. And I go to my first rehab, and he was a good guy. He was a really good guy. He was in the military, and he was going to school, but he was my enabler. He was my codependent. And he didn't have a problem with drugs, but he would drink with me, but he didn't smoke weed or do any other drugs. And so when I got out of that rehab and moved into the SLE, my focus was not only on my son, but on him too, seeing him as much as I can. When are we gonna have time together? And so my number one priority wasn't the program. I wasn't ready to accept the program into my heart and make it a priority. It wasn't fun. I was 21. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to do things that made me feel good, and my boyfriend made me feel good. And so, like, he would pick me up from my SLE on the weekends, and I'd get my weekend passes, and we'd spend time together and with my son, of course. And, but he would drink, on like a Saturday. And I thought, and I told myself, I can handle that. He can drink in front of me. It's not going to bother me. I'm not going to tell him to not drink. What right do I have to tell him not to drink just because I have a problem? And so, yes. So he would drink in front of me, and I was good at first. I didn't drink. It didn't make me want it. I was fine, but I was miserable inside. And then progressively became more and more miserable. I was restless. I was irritable, and I was discontent. I wrote this thing in my big book, see if I can find it. The most dangerous part of the illness of addiction is when we're not drinking, because we're thinking about drinking. And just because we're not putting substances in our body doesn't mean we're cured, we're okay. Because my problem really isn't the drugs and the alcohol. My problem is something inside of me that's missing. There's something missing. And I'm feeding that empty space with all these substances, and it's never going to fulfill that. It does temporarily. So when you take away the substances, then what am I going to fill that hole with? And because I wasn't ready to surrender, I wasn't able to fill that hole with what I really needed to fill it with. And so because that hole's now empty, you're going to be miserable. I was so miserable. So then I'm going to think, what's the point in doing this if I still feel this way? I almost feel worse than I did before. And so one day, one Saturday night, I went to a meeting, and I walked out of that meeting, and I'm like, fuck this feeling. They say to go to meetings and do all this and that, and I'm doing it. Really, I wasn't doing the steps. That's what recovery is, working the steps. For me, my definition It's the meetings are amazing and wonderful and a huge part of this, but really to experience that spiritual experience is working the 12 steps. And so I decided to drink, and I was living in an SLE, like I said, and so I was able to maintain that. I was able to drink on a Saturday a little bit, not get drunk, and then be good the rest of the week. And then the next Saturday I would have a beer and then be good. And so I was like, how, I'm not an alcoholic, because I compared myself to what you see in movies, to my parents, to the stories you hear in these rooms. Just because you can take a drink and put it down doesn't mean that you're okay or that you can handle it, because what matters is how do you feel afterwards? What happens afterwards? What is your behavior and your thinking afterwards? And so I was able to keep that up for a while, but then it progresses. It always progresses. So then I started taking an ecstasy here and there. But I'm not going to touch my drug of choice, is what I told myself. And then I started smoking weed a little bit. And that went on for 6 months. And so one day I found out someone I knew, because I got a job at this restaurant, someone I knew had Norco. And I'm like, you know what? I've been good. I've been able to drink occasionally. I've been able to use party drugs sometimes. And I've been able to maintain my job and not get in trouble. I'm sure I could just take Norco this one time and then I won't touch it again after this. That's insanity. That's insanity. And so I did it, took the Norco. It was amazing. And then that started slowly progressing. So then I would just do it on the weekends. And then my someone I knew, his mother died, and I met with him to hang out with him, and I learned that he was snorting heroin. I had never tried heroin, and I didn't know you could snort heroin. And so he was like, "Do you want to try it?" And I'm like, "No." And I watched him do it, and I thought, "Oh, he's just snorting it." And so I tried it, and it was amazing. It was amazing. And so that slowly became a thing. And now I'm trying to balance these two worlds. This world, I'm living in an SLE, and so I gotta pretend like I'm working the steps and going to meetings, and I have my parents watching me and they're proud of me and thinking that I'm really getting my 90-day chip, but I'm being dishonest. And so my number one goal was to get out of the SLE before I get caught. And so my boyfriend, at the time I didn't think he was an addict, but his addiction progressed slower than mine did. And so he was able to control himself a lot longer. And so eventually he did start using harder drugs. And I remember telling him to try the heroin I had, and I told him it was crushed Percocet. So he didn't even know he was taking heroin, and he used it and he liked it. And then I told him what it was. But so our goal was to get our own apartment. And so we ended up getting our own apartment, and I had my son on the weekends, and I was able to maintain that I was normal or doing good in recovery to my parents. But one day they came to my house, and so my life started spiraling out of control again. And they came to my house, my stepmom did, to drop off my son, and I had taken a Xanax and I blacked out. It's always a Xanax that gets me caught, always. And I don't remember that day, but I guess she came in, I was passed out on the bed, she couldn't really wake me up, and so she knew that I had relapsed. And they took my son away and said, "Brittany, you gotta go back to rehab or you're not gonna see your son." And I was furious, and I really just, I honestly believed it's them. They're the problem. If they would just let me do what I want, then I'd be okay. And that's how the insanity in my mind, it just like, I became so much more skewed than I was before, because now I'm doing heroin and I really think I'm normal and I'm okay and it's them that's the problem. And so I took them to court and I said to myself, when I get in front of that judge, I'm going to tell the judge I'm sober and that they can randomly drug test me. And I believed that when it came time for that random drug test, all I needed to do was not use 3 days before and I'd be fine. And once I got my son back, I would be able to stop using because I'd be happy. It was always something that. So I took him to court, and my grandma was my other codependent, my dad's mother. And so she always believed my lies. And she told me, Brittany, why don't we prepare like now? Why don't I take you to my doctor and we can do a drug test and show that to the judge? And I'm like, that's a great idea, Grandma. Schedule it for next week. And so we had it scheduled, and I told myself, okay, 3 days before Monday, I'm gonna not use. And 3 days came around, and I was like, oh, I'm just gonna use today and I won't use tomorrow. If I drink enough water, it'll be out of my system within 2 days. And day two came around. I couldn't not use that day. And so I needed my grandma. I needed her to continue to believe me, because she helped feed my addiction, because she gave me money when I needed it, bought me groceries when I needed it. She was by my side fighting with me to get my son back. And I knew I had a warrant for my arrest. And so I turned myself in that Monday morning, and I told my boyfriend, I said, call my grandma and tell them they just came to our house and arrested me for the warrant, because she knew I got a DUI like a year before, and so I had a warrant for that. And she believed it. So I put myself in jail to hide from a drug test. That's how insane. Like that was my bright idea. This is, and so I ended up, and then I also thought, I'm killing two birds with one stone. So not only am I saving myself from disappointing my grandma, but when I go to jail, I'll be there for like a couple days, so I can detox there, I can get off the drugs there, and then when I get out, I'll be good. And so I was miserable. God, I was in there for 2 days and I was miserable because I was sick. And the first thing I did when I got out was I went and used, of course. And so I ended up going to court, and I told myself, I really will quit this time before they give me that real random drug test. And our court date was the day before Thanksgiving. And so the judge granted me 2 days of my son, and as long as I do the random drug test. So I'm like, okay, good. Tomorrow's Thanksgiving. No one's going to call me to do a drug test tomorrow. But they did on Thanksgiving. And I remember my mom was my other codependent, and she was going to let me use her pee. And I was going to put the pee in a condom and then put the condom inside of me. And so we're both in the bathroom, and I'm trying to put her pee in this condom, and I can't get it inside. It was just ridiculous. And so I was like, okay, I'm fucked. There's no way. And it was, the lady had to watch me pee. So there's no way I could get away with that anyways. And so, yeah, that was it. I was fucked after that. Excuse my language, but, I peed and it took them a week to get the results. And so I got to see my son one time in that week, and then I got the call from my dad, and he was like, you tested positive, Brittany, go to rehab or stay out of our lives. And he didn't say it like that, but. And so I was like, fuck, I just got out of rehab 8 months ago. This was 8 months after my first treatment experience. And so I had no more options, and I went to rehab again, the same rehab for 30 days. But this time I learned that I actually want this. That I actually have to do the work if I'm going to be sober. Like, it's so crazy. I'm like, fuck everybody, I'm fine. And then right when I get into a rehab, then and after like 3 days of being there, it just hits me. I'm like, oh my God, what was I thinking? I do need this. My life is a mess. I am powerless. My life is unmanageable. It's not them, it's me. It's the drugs, it's the alcohol. And so I was gung-ho. And I got out of that rehab, and I still had the apartment with my boyfriend, and he was able to stop using on his own. He wasn't using every day yet, so he was able to stop when I got out of rehab, and we were living together, and I was going to meetings every single day. I didn't have a car, but I'd walk to meetings, take my son, and push my son in a stroller. He was like 3-4 years old, and I was sometimes going to meetings twice a day. And I was on a pink cloud, and I was feeling really good, and I was really happy. And I got my 90-day chip, and it was real. I was actually sober. My dad was so proud of me. But I wasn't working the steps yet. I found a sponsor, but we didn't dive in yet. And I was kind of being picky about the sponsor I was choosing. But I thought, I'm okay. I'm going to meetings every day. But one day, my boyfriend and I get into a really big fight. And my solution wasn't to call my sponsor. My solution wasn't to go to a meeting because I wasn't in the steps yet. I hadn't even worked step one yet. So my solution in that moment after that fight was to use. And after 3 months of being sober, and I told him, my boyfriend, I had to talk him into it. And I said, please, I promise, like, I'll tell my sponsor I used. I'll be honest. I just want to do it one time. And after talking him into it, I had my son, and we drove over to Vallejo, and we bought what we needed. And I went into the nation's bathroom and snorted it, came out. He's in line ordering food. My son and I are standing outside nations while I'm smoking a cigarette. And all of a sudden, I'm on the ground and turning blue. I had taken too much because I had been sober for 90 days, and so I was overdosing. So my boyfriend finds me on the ground and picks me up and puts me in the car, and he's like trying to wake me up. And I remember bits and pieces of this. He's driving me to Kaiser, and he's pumping my chest as he's driving, and at every red light, he's breathing in my mouth. Now I know that there's no way that saved me, because you have to be on your back on the ground doing that. And so at the time, I thought that's what saved me. So God is what saved me. So when we pulled up to Kaiser, I came out of it all of a sudden. And he's like, do you want to go in? And I'm like, no, I don't want to go in. And so, but yeah, I stopped breathing. My lips were blue. And my son was in the back seat watching the whole thing. And he was 4 years old. And that was the most shame and guilt I had ever felt in my entire life. And it was enough shame and guilt to keep me sober for a time, for 7 days. I stayed sober after that. And every day I felt that pain, that hammering pain in my heart and in my stomach. It consumed me. It was all I could think about. Like, I kept having like flashbacks of that day, because he's just this innocent 4-year-old watching his mom die on the ground, not knowing what's going on. And I remember he tried telling my dad what happened, because he was just with me on the weekends at the time. And my dad called me, and he's like, Luke was saying like something about you on the ground. And I'm like, I don't know what he's talking about. And I made something up. And so he was even trying to express it, but nobody knew what he was talking about. And there's no way I was going to tell them what he was talking about. And so after 7 days, I remember I was sitting home alone. My boyfriend was at work. And I thought to myself, and this is the insanity of it and how we justify and rationalize is, I relapsed after 90 days, and I didn't even get to enjoy it because I overdosed. And the rest of the day, I don't really remember what happened, but I didn't get to feel it or enjoy the high. So what was the point? There might as well be a point to it all. So I decided I'm going to do it one more time so that way I can actually enjoy it, and then I'll get sober. And so I went there to the dealer's house by myself, bought my stuff, came back, used it. And that pain, the guilt and the shame, it went away. I was numb. I finally felt at peace. And so I gotta hurry up. And so eventually I started using every day again, hiding it from my boyfriend too. And then he found out, and then he was like, fine, if you're gonna use, so am I. And so we were using together again. And my dad started noticing there was something wrong with me again, and he was just done with me at that point. And I knew this time I wanted it from the bottom of my heart. I wanted it. And so I put myself into a program at John Muir, and told my dad, I said, Dad, you know, you're right. I there is something wrong, and I'm going to rehab by myself without anyone telling me to do it. I'm doing it on my own. And he's like, Brittany, after this, I'm done after this if you don't make it. And so in that John Muir program, that obsession, it progresses. The obsession progresses as well. And so this time I couldn't even focus in the meetings. I couldn't think about anything but that feeling that I want and I crave and I need. And it was so powerful that I would call my drug dealer during dinner time, and I would have him drop it off at the hospital, the rehab I was staying at, in the parking lot, and I'd go get it. I couldn't focus on anything, even though my heart wanted it now. But every time I relapse, it gets harder and harder to get sober every single time. And so I was trying, and I was being honest with my counselor. I'm like, yes, I relapsed, and I just can't stop. And so he was trying to help me, and I moved out of my boyfriend's apartment into an SLE. And then the house manager there ended up kicking me out because I was high, and he tested me. And I learned about this 90-day program at a meeting from this girl that was a part of that program, and that they allow you to take Suboxone, which is a replacement for opiates. It's like methadone, and it can help you because it feeds that part of your brain, and it quiets it down, so that way you can focus. And so I was like, I never tried it before. And so I ended up leaving that John Muir program, and I put myself into the other program. It was called Recovery Management Services, RMS. And it was a 90-day program in Concord. And I got on Suboxone, and I was finally able to just sit and listen and apply what they suggest. And I did everything that they told me to do. I got a sponsor in that rehab. I started working the steps. My boyfriend went into a program and got sober. And so after the 90 days, I wanted to move back in with him in our apartment. But they were like, no, you should move into our SLE. We have an SLE down the street. And everyone was telling me to do that. But I'm like, no, I have my own apartment. Like, I want to go back home. And then I remembered, because I was fighting everybody on that. Like, I want to go back home. And I was like, you know what? Every decision that I've made on my own has never got me anywhere good. And they keep telling me that I need to surrender. And I never have fully surrendered. So you know what? I'm just going to do it. So I did it. And I did everything that they wanted me to do, even though I didn't want to do it. And that was the key for me, to fully surrender and do what I don't want to do. And so I lived in that SLE for 9 months. And instead of moving back into the apartment with my boyfriend after 9 months, I moved back to my dad's house. And I got to reacclimate into being a mom, an everyday mom, 7 days a week, not just on the weekends. And he was starting to go to kindergarten. So I got him to take him to his first day of school. And then every day after that, I got my driver's license back. I started working at this restaurant, this deli, while I was in rehab because they had a job search program. And I worked there for 3 years. And I found a home group, and I stayed a part of that rehab, going back as an alumni member. I became the alumni president, and I was really attached to that program. And I had my home groups. I finished working my steps. I started going back to the rehab to sponsor women that were in the rehab, and just doing all of everything that they suggest. It changed my life. It's not just the meetings. I need to work step one, to really understand how powerless I am. Step two, to bring this higher power into my life. Step three, to surrender to that higher power. And step four, to really look at my life and do a personal inventory and figure out, okay, the patterns of my life, like the patterns of my resentments and my fears. It was extremely eye-opening, and I really learned on that step four, it's not them, it's me. It's me every single time. Every single time I'm resentful at somebody, it's not them. It's something inside of me. And then step six and seven, figuring out what my character defects are, exactly what they are, and letting them go, and then doing my inventory, my amends, eight and nine. And the amends, that's the ninth step. Promises come after doing those amends. I remember hearing those promises and thinking that these things aren't happening, and then learning those are ninth step promises. These promises really start coming true after working your ninth step. And that is when I had my spiritual experience, is the ninth step. And then 10, maintaining this, always looking at my day every day and figuring out, did I hurt somebody? Was I dishonest? What good things did I achieve today? So that way I can make the amends the next day if I need to. And then 11, meditation. 12 was life-changing, because helping other women is what really gave me the drive and the want and the need to keep going. Because watching a woman, watching the light come on in her eyes and watching her grow and change is a spiritual experience in itself. And then I learned that I have a passion for helping people. And so I started working as a drug and alcohol counselor at the rehab I got sober at. And that was 4 years ago. And now I'm working at a women's program in Concord called the Frederick Ozenham Center. and helping women who are coming off the streets, coming out of jail. And I got to remember, my program isn't that job, because it can be really easy to feel like, oh, I've been talking about recovery all day, I don't want to go to a meeting. So I got to find balance and remember that my recovery is separate from my job. And today I have my own apartment with my son. It's just me and him, that boyfriend. We stayed sober for 4 years together. We got engaged, but we outgrew each other. And so I'm a single mom. It's just me and my son. And I have my amazing best friends, and we travel and we go on vacations and we have girls trips. And my life is amazing. It's not perfect, but my best day getting high does not compare to my worst day sober. And so I want to thank you so much for having me share. I can't believe I actually talked for an hour. I could keep going, but I'm not. And so, yeah, thank you so much, Joe.
So let's see, we covered everything. Kim, there is plenty of ribs, so help yourselves, take some home. There's all sorts of ribs, and really want to appreciate everybody for coming out and participating. We really enjoyed having you, and it was a good time. So, and again, I want to thank you, Brittany. Appreciate it. Let's round up and we'll do a semi-circle thing. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, moment of silence for those still suffering, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Keep coming back, it works.
That worked?
What yeah, well, I think so. I got to turn it off, though.
Yeah, she's doing really good.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
What was it? Oh, just the voice recorder that's already on there?
I remember you coming to the little